dropped him a few months before I fell out. He gets the whole kit and caboodle. Now, I've been trained to run these affairs, too, and I have no affairs to run now. Now, I'm going to go find myself some downtrodden masses somewhere, don't know any better than run them. I don't really care if they're white, black, yellow, green. I don't even care if they're lizards, as long as they can serve me. But I feel guilty doing that. Therefore, I must have a rationale. I've been given this training to bring it to these downtrodden people who must serve me while I elevate them. You got it? Well, now, the Dutch fled the Catholics and carved out a territory in South Africa with the Bible under one hand, under one arm, as I said. Sure as the world. If God had sent them to South Africa to do what God sent Joshua into Palestine to do. And here come these tea-drinking English speakers with enough money to buy the Cape trying to anglicize us. Now we got the Yankees versus the Southern plantation owners, and it don't have a damn thing to do with race. Freeing the slaves, bless old Lincoln's heart, I believe he had character, and there were many, a lot of preachers who hid the runaway slaves. Some of them wrote their sermons with a slave under the floor of the study they wrote their sermon in, facing prison and death for hiding a runaway slave. A lot of them had deep, abiding moral convictions. But they couldn't have carried the day if it hadn't have been for economic interests that motivated other people to bring the South under. And a lot of the Southerners used moral arguments justifying slavery just because they wanted states' rights, independence, and the economic advantage of slaves. And they'd use such arguments as, we love them, patronage. We love them as individuals. The Northerners love them as a mass. We love them as individuals. Everybody does that. The colored headhunters in Dutch New Guinea liked white meat. You know what happened to the cannibal chieftain when he ate a Catholic priest and a Baptist missionary and a Mormon missionary? He had an ecumenical movement. Just thought I'd throw that in, lest we get too intellectual here. Lionel Curtis said, if political power is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. You just lance the boil, as Jesse Jackson said. Doesn't matter, you know, the analogy is, I'm not sure that he knows it, but the analogy is absolutely presupposing the communist frame of reference about the value of individuals. They're equated to cells in a boil. It must be destroyed as you lance a wound, but you know, the arm will heal itself. Doesn't matter how many people get killed, dialectic materialism in its process will heal and the new synthesis will be better. And you know, what matters that a few people get killed? They don't have eternal souls. They don't live forever. There's no immortality. There's no eternal outside of the stream of history. They've made a contribution to the ultimate purpose of history. The end justifies the means. Just give them a little bit more power now. Before they're fit, they'll tend to rise to the need. This was the spirit which Milner's group tried to use toward the Boers in 1902 to 1910. toward India in 1910 to 1947, unfortunately toward Hitler in 1933 to 39. This point of view is reflected in Curtis's three volumes on world history, published in 1938. In the case of Hitler, these high ideals led to disaster. In the case of Khomeini, these high ideals led to disaster. The choice was not the Shah. You'll give him credit. It was the Shah's wife that outlawed the Kerman rugs, woven by kids under 16 years of age, 16 hours a day. The weaving was so tight that only children's fingers could do it, and children were in virtual slavery, weaving those Kerman rugs that represent the only assets you can walk on, and it increases in value. They went blind. One master would march up and down and chant, and by the chanting they'd weave the colors, and the other one would force them to work. She outlawed it. Sure, the Shah's secret police and other things that he did were wrong. Now the people got the guns. And I have an idea the majority are in favor of the old Ayatollah, the holy man. Is the world better off? The white man and his oil interests out of Iran. The world better off? One of the great tragedies is that when we have to fight communism, the number of blacks that have to die. You ever notice that? Am I boring you?
No, sir.
I don't want my face to revolve, just run a crawl. But these ideas were not solely. Well, in the case of Hitler, at least, these ideals led to disaster. This seems also to be the case in South Africa. But these ideas were not solely those of Curtis, but were held by the group as a whole, will be clear to all who study it. When Lord Lothian died in Washington in 1940, Curtis published a volume of his speeches and included the obituary which Grigg had written for the Round Table. Of Lothian, this said, "He held that men should strive to build the kingdom of heaven here upon this earth, and that the leadership in that task must fall first and foremost upon the English-speaking peoples." Other attitudes of this influential group can be gathered from some quotations from four books published by Curtis in 1916 to 1920. Just the moral imperative. When you have somebody sitting down and trying to win a debate saying, "Well, if it's right, do it," that ends the argument. It's right not to go to war. That's what the clergymen in Germany said as their high ideals let them stand aside while Hitler took over Germany and gassed 6 million Jews. The clergy of Germany could have stopped it, but their ideals would not let them go to war. You don't have in international relations the choice between good and evil. You have choices, most of the time, the lesser of the evils. And you can always play into the communist hand when you have some moral imbecile that's so heavenly minded he's of no earthly good, arguing these high moral imperatives, disregarding the reality that the immediate choice is always the lesser of the evils, and which of the choices enable you to make progress toward the ultimate good without playing into that revolutionary philosophy of the communist. You don't get that choice. Good versus evil. The communists believe that too. Except they incorporate into the good the bad. The bad of the revolution dialectically is compelled by the process, which is self-cleansing to produce a synthesis which is a higher good. Therefore, the revolution is good because of what will come out of it. Idealists on the Western side must be good at all costs. It's the extension of that nonsensical idea that man can perfect himself. We're sinners. And the choice by statesmen recognizes lesser of evils. Nobody is asking the world to stand still and see South Africa remain the same forever and rationalize its sameness. But having expressed ourselves, gotten the attention, they never had television, as I've said, this is the third time, until 1976. Give the pressure a chance to take hold. Don't push it to the brink of revolution or bloodshed intensified on one side or the other. With that philosophic foundation, let's watch it work. We were in Egypt. The extravagancies of Khedive Ismail, from whom the Suez Canal had been bought, which had compelled the sale of his Suez Canal shares, this Egyptian ruler's extravagances and exploitation of his people, and wastefulness, compelled the sale of his Suez Canal shares and gave the opportunity for the imperialists of the group we've been reading about under Disraeli to seize control of the Suez Canal by a purchase that had to be the only rival by our Louisiana purchase and our Alaska purchase as bargains. It led ultimately to the creation of an Anglo-French condominium to manage the Egyptian foreign debt and to the deposition of the Khedive by his under-ruler, the Sultan of Turkey. The condominium led to disputes and finally to open fighting between Egyptian nationalists and Anglo-French forces. When the French refused to join the British in a joint bombardment of Alexandria in 1882, their condominium or consortium was broken, and Britain reorganized the country in such a fashion that while all public positions were held by Egyptians, a British army was in occupation. British advisors controlled all the chief governmental posts, and the British resident, Sir Evelyn Baring, known as Lord Cromer after 1892, controlled all finances and really ruled the country until 1907. I can't hardly wait to get back to the Lost Tribes. This is exactly what Joseph did down in Egypt. I mean, they've had long practice, these sons of Joseph, in acting like their father. Am I boring you? Inspired by fanatical Muslim religious agitators, dervishes, the Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed, led a Sudanese revolt against Egyptian control in 1883. Massacred a British force under General Charles Chinese Gordon at Khartoum and maintained an independent Sudan for 15 years. History's sort of repeating itself, isn't it? Am I boring you?
No, sir.
In 1898, a British force under Lord Kitchener, seeking to protect the Nile water supply of Egypt, fought its way southward against fanatical Sudanese tribesmen, won a decisive victory at Omdurman. An Anglo-Egyptian convention established... I love this area because I collect Sudan and Egypt stamps. I love it. An Anglo-Egyptian convention established a condominium known as the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan in the area between Egypt and the Congo River. This area, which had lived in disorder for centuries, was gradually pacified, brought under the rule of law, irrigated by extensive hydraulic works and brought under cultivation, producing chiefly long staple cotton. Well, eventually time caught up, and British control over Northeast Africa is lost, and they're gone. And political power was given to those before they were fit, and they have risen to the fitness. That's why we have to feed them. And we have live aids, and we raise millions, and they're still trying to get it to them. And Jerry Falwell's right. In those areas formerly under British control, now they're under people control. And they're fighting with each other. But that isn't news. That's just blacks killing blacks. That's not news. 670 some whites and more blacks in South Africa is much more newsworthy than 670,000 being starved to death in Northeast Africa. That's not newsworthy. Not newsworthy at all. That's blacks killing blacks. And we send them food and put it in trucks, and they bomb the trucks. And they say you can only eat the food that's delivered by us gullible idealists in the West if you go into the camps under communist control and eat it there. They are mass-moving, large population groups, forcing mass exodus of people in numbers so far beyond the Bantustans of South Africa, which has the same idea, which puts the pressure on localized, transforming, bulldozing areas, moving people somewhere else. It's kindergarten in comparison to what's being done in Northeast Africa. Whole tribes and generations of people are being wiped out or moved where the communists can control you. Why don't we have the whole world? Why don't we sanction that area? No, we got to feed that area. I mean, it's as though we have to create areas in the world so we can show off how moral we are. Create a starvation center so we can feel good about feeding them. I'll feed the hungry and the orphans of this world that I've fed up against any of my critics. And I'm not going to tolerate stupidity that intimidates a factual analysis that is honest. Doesn't make anything done in South Africa right. One person abused is as important as 1 million abused as a moral issue, because moral issues are not to be quantified. Morality as a law says you have no more right to be concerned about your baby than a starving baby in China. But human reality recognizes that's part of God's law of the universe. If He could make us all brethren, we would be concerned about the brethren that are close to us, and each brother will be concerned about those close to him, and the chain reaction would balance it. That's idealism. Now let's talk about East Central Africa. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
We haven't got to South Africa in detail yet, but we're getting there. South and east of the Sudan, the struggle for British Africa was largely in the hands of H.H. Sir Harry Johnston, 1858 to 1927, and Frederick, later Lord Lugard, 1858 to 1945. These two, chiefly using private funds, but frequently holding official positions, fought all over tropical Africa, ostensibly seeking to pacify it and to wipe out the Arab slave trade. Now, I collect the missionary stamps of Africa. You can't be a good stamp collector without reading history. course, I was an undergraduate major in history anyway. I read for the history prof through all my master's years. Out of gas. Come prepared. With alternates. Little object lesson. Come to South Africa with alternates. One of the missionaries that I collect was a Catholic priest and his correspondents who ran a eunuch factory in Northeast Africa. He supported his parish by raising eunuch boys feeding them well and training them and supplying the slave trade. You think I'm kidding you, don't you? I mean, you know, the work of God had to go on. And since there were going to be eunuchs and slaves, don't leave it to chance. I mean, if you can't whip them, join them. So this priest ran a eunuch factory. Now, he produced the best young eunuch boys, trained in the kinds of things necessary to be a good servant. And in those Arab countries with their harems, you didn't turn a non-eunuch loose tending your wives. Those old boys were that smart. But, you know, all we hear about Africa. Well, let's go on. Ostensibly seeking to pacify Africa and wipe out the Arab slave trade, but always possessing a burning desire to extend British rule. I mean, if you can find a moral issue, when we get to the bottom of South Africa, there are some people that want some change in South Africa that are outside South Africa that aren't half as concerned with the blacks as they're acting like. I want to tell you that there are just an awful lot of bankers, an awful lot of economic competitors to South Africa, an awful lot of people with financial reasons for fanning this issue that don't give a diddly damn if every black in Africa were buried tomorrow. It is a good moral issue to justify their real purposes. People that really care about South Africa want the problem solved without the blacks or the whites wiping each other out. That's going to happen if the flames keep being fanned. Just like these people. Ostensibly seeking to pacify tropical Africa and wipe out the Arab slave trade. That's what made the front pages. These heroes are down there wiping out the slave trade. What they were really after was to extend British rule. Frequently, these ambitions led to rivalries with supporters of French and German ambitions in the same regions. Do you have any idea how much Canada is making with the shift to Canadian maple leaves instead of South African Krugerrands as the method to lay gold in store right now? I mean, there's just an awful lot of reason for Canada to be very moral about this issue. The ban on Krugerrands is not going to help black South Africa a quarter turn. going to make a lot of Americans that had laid some Krugerrands in store suffer. The French and the Germans had ambitions in these same regions. Some banks have got some ambitions in South Africa, my friends. In 1884, Johnston obtained many concessions from native chiefs in the Kenya area, turning these over to the British East Africa Company in 1887. When this company went bankrupt in 1895, most of its rights were taken over by the British government. In the meantime, Johnston had moved south into a chaos of Arab slavers, intrigues, and native unrest in Nyasaland. Here, his exploits were largely financed by Rhodes in order to prevent the Portuguese Mozambique Company from pushing westward toward the Portuguese West African colony of Angola to block the Cape to Cairo route. It's like the days of the robber barons. Africa was a pie to be divided up. Lord Salisbury made Nyasaland a British protectorate after a deal with Rhodes in which the South African promised to pay £10,000 a year toward the cost of the new territory. About the same time, Rhodes gave the Liberal Party a substantial financial contribution in return for a promise they wouldn't abandon Egypt. He had already, in 1888, given £10,000 to the Irish Home Rule Party on condition that it seek home rule for Ireland while keeping Irish members in the British Parliament as a step toward imperial federation. These chess players were stirring up the problems all of us are inheriting all over the world today. Now, to the moralists, I want you to know, a six-month-old white baby in a suburb of Cape Town and a six-month-old black baby in the colored town have the same value in God's eyes. They are both the innocent victims of a long history. The tragedy is the six-month-old white baby, if left alone 10 years ago, would have been educated just as these young British sons were educated, into a moral blinding of his conscience to the rightness of what he's doing, until in his own way he'd be as blind as the Nazi youth were blinded into deifying the state, and in the interest of purifying what they had deified, their conscience was not even pricked with the gassing of Jews. They could just dismiss it as necessary to the furtherance of the state that they had deified. You don't turn that kind of education around with a hammer. You're not going to put a peach pitter inside the skull of that 30-year-old Afrikaner that's grown up with one frame of reference. He now knows he has to change. But there are plenty on the white side of the fence telling him he doesn't have to change. And those that are saying he has to change in order to get the minimal support they can hope for from the United States until the process takes place, and they are absolutely convinced that unless they make change, they're going to die one way or the other. And their only hope is the United States. Now, that hope's going to be taken away.